Hi, and welcome to the Rare Business Podcast. My name is Adrian Swinsko, and I'm a consultant, advisor, researcher, and writer on all things related to customer service and customer experience. Through this podcast, I seek out and interview CEOs, entrepreneurs, business and tech leaders, and leading thinkers about what it takes to build organizations that produce better outcomes for both customers and employees in this fast-moving modern age that we live in. If this is your first time listening to one of these interviews, then welcome. And please do dive into the archives at adrianswinsko.com, as I've now completed over 250 of these interviews in the last few years. If this is not your first time listening, then thank you for returning, and I'll aim to do a good enough job to keep you coming back week after week. Anyway, that's enough from me right now. Let's get into the interview. So, welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Aaron Dignan, who is founder of The Ready, an organization design and transformation firm, and author of a new book that we're going to talk about today. Hey, Aaron, how are you doing?
I am quite well. Let's do this.
Very well. So, Aaron, for the benefit of our listeners and also readers, because we do the highlights, extended highlights of these interviews too, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and also about the work that you do?
Yeah, so I spend most of my time inside organizations, predominantly in the US, but also around the world, really focused on the idea of how do we change the way we work? How do we move from, you know, bureaucracy to something more adaptive and more human? Mm-hmm. So I'm one part coach and one part advisor and, you know, try to be a little bit of a provocateur. And then I also kind of a guinea pig on myself. So the organization that I founded called The Ready does this work in lots of different places around the world. And we have a collection of members who are actively experimenting with new ways of working every day inside our own company. So we are, you know, doing, we're living it, and then we're trying to share it as well.
Perfect. Now, I'm really interested in new ways of working, and particularly because I'm interested in how do we use that as a tool to help us deliver better outcomes for customers and employees, because that's kind of my main point of interest. But I also must say, sure, that I've been a subscriber to the Ready's newsletter for a while, which I really enjoy, and that's how I found out about this new book that you've just published, which is called Brave New Work: Are You Ready to Reinvent Your Organization? So I have it in my hand, and it's got some incredible names and comments in the past, so on the back cover. So hopefully you're blushing when you read those, because there's some big there are some big names in there. But can you tell me about the book and sort of how it came about and kind of what's its main thesis?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that we discovered in the early days of The Ready is that because of the mindset shift and kind of the argument that we have to make against traditional management and structures is so profound and really needs to be kind of given its due time, it started to make me think maybe a book would be a way to get there, because, you know, you take a long plane ride or you sit down on the beach for a few hours and you can be in an idea.
Right.
And I think because the way we work is so embedded and so ingrained, we just so rarely have the time to hear that argument and to stop and just think and question, you know, are we, is the way we're working serving us?
Right.
So the thought was maybe get it all down, get it out as much as we've learned along the way, as a starting point, as a starting point for a broader conversation. So I started working on it about 18 months ago, and which was also an interesting experiment because, you know, the company at the time was only about a year and a half old. Mm. So I had this year and a half old baby and started writing the book, which really required me to be away from the business and away from my colleagues for most of the day, most of the week.
Right.
So it was a really interesting experiment in, have we done enough in terms of putting the groundwork for a self-managing company into place that I can actually disappear for a year,
right,
and it won't be completely defunct on the other end. So that was kind of the genesis and the origin. And I mean, the book really is one part manifesto, one part playbook. So
right,
it has three main sections or arguments. The first one is really about the past and the future of work. So how the heck did we get here, and where are we going? And then the second part really takes a, a, a deep dive into what's changing. Like, what is the, you know, we start talking about the future of work or new ways of working or better ways of working. What the hell do we mean? And I kind of provide a construct for exploring that. And then the third part of the book is, you know, hey, that all sounds great, but how do we change, right?
Sure.
So it's one thing to believe it. It's another thing to do it. And so really talking about all the, you know, hard-fought lessons that we've learned trying different approaches to change and what has ultimately started to work for us.
Okay. I mean, that's brilliant. I mean, but I guess there are no shortage of books that are advocating different kind of like models or different ways of kind of working. I mean, but I guess it seems to me what you're identifying, there's a core problem that you're trying to address with the book. Can you tell me just a little bit? Well, I think that that's my assumption and that's my belief in sort of being going through the book. I mean, can you tell us a little bit more about what you think the core problem that exists that you're trying to address, and that why we have to think about a new way of working?
I think the central argument and sort of the core problem is that the way we work was invented on a factory floor 100 years ago,
right?
Which was all about kind of separating the thinking from the doing, and the managers from the, you know, employees and peons, and having an approach of control and compliance and hierarchy and red tape and really, you know, bureaucratic boundaries as the way to maintain control and ensure productivity and efficiency.
Right.
And that was the way it was done, and that has really been inherited. The problem is that both kind of, you know, empirically and emotionally, that no longer works as well as it used to. The world has changed in a massive amount, you know, of different ways, mm-hmm. from the cultural changes to just the pace and dynamics of the marketplace, to how global we are, to, you know, all the new technology that's changing everything. The list goes on and on. We have rockets that can land themselves.
Yes.
But we're still running businesses
most of the time, that is,
100 years ago, you know, most of the time, sure, at all. Right.
Yeah.
You know, there are miracles happening. And yet at the same time, when I ask to see an organization's org chart and how they make decisions, it's almost indistinguishable from something that's a century old. So either it's perfect, which would be the case if everybody were thrilled at work. But as you know, one in two people is thinking about quitting their job and is disengaged. So it's not working. And actually, when you look at things like corporate longevity or return on assets, it's not working empirically either. So I think there's a kind of a degradation happening beneath our feet, and we're pushing really hard. We're riding the bike as hard as we can to kind of keep delivering the goals and the growth and the outcomes that we want. But there needs to be a moment to stop and just say, wait a second.
Yeah.
Are the underlying assumptions of this approach correct anymore?
Right.
If they ever were. And what are we going to do about that?
And so, you can say that was it one in two people that are looking to sort of change their job and things? And there's an old saying that says people join companies but leave bosses.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And yeah. And I'm thinking, well, you know, if you change the organizational structure, that's possibly only one part of the picture, right? Because you've also got to change the sort of almost the way that people are managed and led in those structures as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think when we think about it, we talk about it as an operating system or,
right,
you know, an OS. And the idea is that there's a lot of different components. And in fact, not only do you have to change more than one, but they're all very interdependent. Right. So
yeah,
the whole kind of culture of work is holding itself up in the same way that the whole, you know, economic system is holding itself up based on all these reinforcing mechanisms.
Right. Okay. So given all of that, I mean, what should people be asking themselves when they kind of, you know, because it's like, I guess to drive kind of change, or to get the first thing you've got to create is a dissatisfaction with the current status quo.
Right. Right.
So how do we create that dissatisfaction? I mean, what should people be asking themselves to kind of like open the door or pull back the curtains, and then they go, oh, shock horror.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you can also motivate change with curiosity about what's possible. So
right,
it is, you know, what I'm finding is that a lot of the early adopters are maybe frustrated with the old ways, but also just kind of open to the never ending quest, right? They want to keep pushing forward, but there's no shortage of dissatisfaction. So we can start there. And, you know, the question I engage most teams with when I first meet them is just, what's stopping you from doing the best work of your life?
Right.
Which is sounds like a pretty heady question, but if you just really stop for 15 seconds and think about it, is can be quite tactical, right? Like what is it that's in the way, right? Is it a boss? Is it, you know, that you don't have time? Is it that you don't have resources? Is it that you don't like your colleagues? Is it that, you know, you don't have the information you need? Is it that you're in meetings all the time, right? There are good reasons that are pretty top of mind for most teams that I meet with.
Right.
And they can go right to them. You know, we prioritize the short term over the long term here, and that kills us. Oh, right. Okay. So, you know, you get into that stuff. I think that's the starting place. And then the second question is the one we never ask, which is, great, so what are you going to do about it?
Right.
Like, let's say we do one of those things. Now, what are the options? What are the alternatives? And what I think we don't do a great job of in culture and in media around business is exposing some of the, you know, thinking. And I would almost call it new thinking, but it's really not. It's fringe thinking that's been there for a long time. You know, many of the businesses that I studied in the book have been around for decades and decades, doing things differently and with remarkable aplomb. And yet, you don't see them on the cover of HBR, right? So there's just a missing piece there of kind of knowing where to look, and then a willingness to try something and to kind of break some of the patterns of thinking that stop us from trying, right? Because we love to do big moves, and we love to plan the moves, and we love to be sure.
Yeah.
And all those things that we're used to and addicted to often prevent us from saying, what's just one small change that we could make this week on that issue, that tension?
Yeah,
that would help us move forward.
You know, I think that's absolutely right. I think it strikes me that, you know, there's an element of, you mentioned there's organizations that have been around for decades, and you talk about making decisions and getting people involved and so on and so forth. And it strikes me that there are companies that have been out there that have been doing this for decades. I mean, you know, people like Toyota come to mind with their Toyota management system and their quality circles and, you know, the Gemba idea and Kaizen and all of that type of stuff, but it almost like falls off the immediate consciousness if it's not talked about and not adopted by by the majority. Right. Do you know what I mean?
And it doesn't play to our desire for the quick fix, right? It's not a framework that you can pin on the wall. It's not a you know, a thing that you can get certified in. I think, you know, when you go look at quotes from Taichi Ono, who was really involved in that movement at Toyota, he says, think for yourself. Stop trying to borrow wisdom.
Yes.
You know, get in the shit and get your hands dirty.
Yeah.
Nobody really likes that, right? That seems like we're too busy for that, or that seems scary. So there is there's a kind of a mental barrier around that stuff.
Do you think it's also kind of apart from it also requires people to think rather than to do, and therefore there's emotional labor associated with it?
Absolutely.
And we have
emotional
to
labor and accountability, right? I mean,
right.
If I think for myself and I change it instead of doing what everybody does, then it's kind of on me.
Yes. So also then, in terms of other companies that you mentioned in the early part of the book, you mentioned kind of W.L. Gore and Favi, and you consider them to be evolutionary organizations. I mean, I guess those are the ones that are in that they're taking collective responsibility for managing themselves. I mean, what I didn't see, but I did look up in the index, and there are mentioned, is Semco. And I wanted to ask you whether you thought Semco was an evolutionary organization, because with Semco and Ricardo Semler, I remember reading Maverick back in the day, probably over 20 years ago. And I thought it was a story at the time. I thought it was a fictional thing, you know, for a passing moment. I'm like, how can this be real?
Yeah, it's like the Phoenix Project or The Goal. It's a parable.
It's like sci-fi in many ways. You look at it and just go, wow, that's crazy, but amazing and brilliant. I mean, would you consider them an evolutionary organization?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, they were included in the research and in the list, and I think Ricardo is, you know, has been up to some really powerful stuff for a long time.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, they're a really good example, especially in South America, where, you know, often it can be a little harder to dig up cases like this. So, yeah, Semco is quite squarely in that space. And I think they've done a good job of not only doing the work, but also telling the story with books like Maverick and with his TED Talk and with, you know, some of their other publications and you know, podcasts and training, even the Semco Institute. So, yeah, I think they're a stellar example.
Fantastic. So the other thing that kind of struck me when you were when I was going through the book is this, a central concept in the book is this idea of organizational debt. And then I was looking at that and I was going, okay, I'm going to get my head around this. It's like, can you, so kind of for the dummies in the class, and I include myself in that, can you explain what that is and how it affects the work that we do?
Yeah, so organizational debt is kind of a fun one, and it's not a term that I coined, but it is something that we've really leaned into at the Ready. Steve Blank, actually, I think, first brought it up. He was one of the lean startup pioneers, and he was talking about all the people and culture compromises that are made just to get it done in the early stages of a startup, and that those can kind of bite you in the ass later.
Yeah.
So you think about, you know, financial debt, obviously, you borrow money, you got to pay it back, you got to pay interest on it. It's a pretty simple concept. Technical debt is another one that I think a lot of people now are becoming more familiar with in software development, where you kind of take those shortcuts in the beginning and in the way you're writing the code, or you make choices in writing the code that later on may create challenges for you, right?
Right.
It may not work, or it may break at a certain point, or it may not scale. And I think organizational debt is really just talking about the idea that there are things in our organization, whether they be structures or policies or processes, but things that we've made decisions about that are no longer serving us and that kind of sit on the balance sheet, so to speak,
right,
and really tax us. So let's say we created a travel policy 10 years ago when we were a 10-person company, and now we're a 1,000-person company, but we never updated it.
Yeah.
Chances are it's probably hurting us in some way. It's probably not appropriate. It's not fit to context. And what's fascinating about people, as you know, and obviously there's been a big explosion of awareness around this with Marie Kondo and her book and her show, you know, Tidying Up, is we're great at adding, not so good at taking away.
Yeah.
So you look at the garage or the kitchen drawer, you'll see that we're just garbage at taking away. And when you think then about organizations, they have all this scar tissue then from, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, 100 years in some cases of existence, policies on policies on policies, and approvers on top of approvers on top of approvers, and roles on top of roles. And they're really, there's no one whose job it is to simplify,
right?
Everyone has a job to continue to add things to protect us and prevent problems and ensure success and all this kind of thing. But, you know, nobody can take away. And then worst of all, we rotate jobs so much in the modern economy that I come in for a year or two and then I go on to the next thing, and you do that a few times and then you ask your boss, why do we do it this way?
Sure.
Nobody knows, right? All the people that built the fence are gone. So we don't know, and then we sort of assume, well, it must be right.
It is
so
what
let's just do it by the book. And I was with an organization recently in the middle of the country in the US, and we were talking about a financial policy, and they were saying, you know, part of onboarding here is just sort of learning to accept this process that everyone agrees is Byzantine, right? It's
right.
Sort of like a rite of passage. So that's org debt. And you know, the question is really, if you had a blank sheet of paper, would you have the same structures and policies? And if the answer is no, then you have work to do.
So if I kind of loop in the question that you kind of asked earlier about what's stopping you from doing the best work of your life, is that kind of one of the best ways to raise awareness of the existence of organizational debt?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to start, right? Because you find out what's stopping people. You can hypothesize all you like about what's useful and what isn't useful, but people will tell you.
Yeah.
And so I have another client a few years back that had an internal process that required 16 approvals.
Wow.
And the person who had to run that paper was like, man, this is just completely ridiculous. But of course, each of those 16 approvals, A, didn't really know what all the other work was involved, and B, they didn't have to run it around, so they got their say and there was no cost to them.
Yes.
Other than the sort of macro cost of just being so slow and really, you know, being immobilized. And so I think, you know, the greater pattern here is really in our fervor for risk avoidance, we create the greatest risk of all, which is to be immobilized and to be unchanging and to be unable to adapt. And that's, you know, that'll kill you faster than almost anything else, really, at the end of the day.
Absolutely. I mean, it's another way of looking at the sort of the organizational debt. It's another way of looking at it. It's almost like friction in a system in many
ways.
Sure,
yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, if it, you know, the friction is the interest, right? So if it creates tension, friction, you know, slows things down, agitates, then that's the interest that you're paying on the policy.
Fantastic. I tell you what, when you were talking there about having somebody that possibly looks at all the identifies all the debt, as it were. It reminded me of a conversation that I'd had with a chap by the name of Rory Sutherland, who is an ad guy here in the UK.
Sure, yeah.
Do you know Rory Sutherland?
Yeah, for sure.
And he riffed on this idea that he reckons that there is a business case to be made for a chief detail officer. Because it's all about kind of finding the small things and eliminating them, because nobody takes care of the details. Everybody's focused on the big stuff, right?
I think that's a symptom for sure, and I think it's a humorous concept. I think the bigger need is really to empower all teams to refactor their org debt all the time, right? And that's how that role kind of comes to life in a real way.
Absolutely. But let me go back to the kind of question that you asked, the big question, what's stopping you from doing the best work of your life? Because I'm fascinated by questions, because I do quite a lot of, it's a lot almost like coaching style advisory kind of work. And questions can be real keys to opening doors for people. And so I'm curious about, did that just poof, spontaneously appear one day, that question, or kind of where did it come from? I'm always curious where really great questions come from.
Yeah, so we have these tension and practice cards in the Ready Now, and they're about 78 in each deck.
Right.
And they are the things that we've heard over and over as a response to that question.
Right.
And what's funny is that there's a circular relationship between the question and the answers, because what we used to do back in the day is actually ask people to describe the time in their career when they did the best work of their lives. So we would start, before we had these cards and we knew all the answers, we would ask people to do an activity where we'd say, describe to me the characteristics of the project that you worked on at some point in your career that was the best work of your life. What was it like? Who was in charge? What was the budget? How big was the team? How did you work? We got all those things. And so people would sort of document that as a team, a leadership team. They'd put it all up on the wall. And not surprisingly, the groupings of things would start to feel a lot like the things you'd expect, right? We had a lot of autonomy. The challenge was really big but inspiring. We had, we took risks.
Sure.
We were in lockstep. We were cross-functional. We communicated. I mean, the list goes on and on, right?
Yeah.
And then we asked people to list what's stopping them right now? So what's holding you back?
Right.
What's driving you crazy? And they listed a whole bunch of other things. And after doing that activity for a year or so, we looked at the two questions of, what was the best work of your life like and what's stopping you? And we were like, let's put these together into one question and use that as a jumping off point, since it kind of mixed the positive psychology with the more critical.
Yeah.
That's kind of how we stumbled into it. It just turns out to be the simplest, leanest, shortest way to get to cut right to the chase.
Absolutely. I just think it's great. And actually getting people, sometimes, like you say, people could sometimes get a bit stuck, but if you get them to base their answers on their, relative to their best experiences, I think it really kind of opens up. It makes it very personal, and it opens up a huge kind of well of ideas. I mean, I've done the same thing when we've talked about, styles of management leadership, and you get people to recall their best coach or their best boss or their best teacher or somebody that's loomed large in their life and had a really positive influence on their life. And you get them to talk about all that sort of stuff and what they were and what they weren't sort of thing. And then you go like, there's your model for leadership,
mm-hmm.
And it's a bit like, and tell me why you're not being like that. And then they're like going, it's a bit of a Homer Simpson moment. It's like,
duh.
So, Aaron, can you bring this to life for me? And can you give me a couple of examples of firms that you've helped can transform? Because actually, this is not theory. This is based on learning from practice. It's not just theory. It's about learning from practice. So can you give me a couple of examples of firms that you've helped transform the way that they work? And, what did they do? What they didn't do? How long did it take? That sort of stuff. And, the sort of business benefits they've seen as a result, just to give some practical color to what we're talking about here.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there are so many stories to grab from, and all of them are different, right? Because the OS is so nuanced. But
sure.
The kinds of things that happened. So, like, we went in with one leadership team in in a, you know, fairly large, fairly prominent company in the educational space. And, you know, one of the tensions was, hey, we're thinking hard about growth, and mm-hmm. we're kind of challenged in that area, and we're struggling a little bit on vision. And one of the reasons is that we have no time, and the reason we have no time is because we have meetings all the time.
Right.
So we have, you know, we have all of our collective meetings, and then we have a lot of one-on-ones where every function has to meet with every executive, so that executive can get their needs met and politic and do all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And so, you know, the tension was too many meetings, not enough time to think, which is a great place to start. And so, you know, the suggestion was, what if we did a meeting moratorium?
Right.
What if we stopped meeting for 2 weeks and then see how it feels? And what did we miss and what hurts? And mm-hmm. and so one of the pieces of advice in the book is, you know, sometimes the best thing you can do is start by stopping.
Yes.
So, you know, we love to add, but it's more interesting often to just leave the negative space and see what fills it naturally rather than trying to solve the problem from the top. So start by stopping. Don't do that for a while. And then rebuild consciously. So that, you know, that particular operathon was rebuilt one meeting at a time over the course of many weeks, and each meeting was bespoke. It was sort of like, all right, how's it going to be facilitated, and how's it going to be, you know, managed, and how are we going to document it, and what, you know, what do we want to get out of it? And every time we finished an iteration of it, we'd ask, you know, what do we need that we didn't get, and what have we learned, and how can we do better next time? And, you know, after 8 weeks of practice and layering in the things that we needed, we had a much, much, much thinner, probably 3x thinner operathon in terms of time commitment, and a discipline around having quality meetings, and people had the time to think.
Wow.
And so, you know, wouldn't you know it, that's a little healthier. Another example, we went into a factory, to a manufacturing facility,
uh-huh.
where they had been, you know, interested and challenged with kind of adopting agile methods for a while, and had been subject to a series of layoffs and other things that just kind of made the emotional tenor of the place a little bit dark. I mean, you know, it's hard to keep your spirits up when you're grappling with stuff like that, and you're dealing with layoffs, and the general, you know, sense is we don't know how to move forward. So we actually, you know, we started to introduce, you know, new ways to meet and new ways to communicate that promoted things like equanimity of voice, so equal talk time among members.
Right.
You know, making sure that diverse perspectives are being heard. We introduced new ways to make decisions that included different perspectives, but also used structure to make sure that we made decisions quickly and that we made them in a way that they were kind of consented to and final. And we actually measured, you know, surprising things. Like we measured smiles in the hallway instead of productivity for a while.
Okay.
To just say, like, what is the vibe, right? What is happening here at a kind of emergent cultural level? And then once we felt like we had the spirit of the place back in check from the participation and from the sense of hope and from introducing new practices, then we started to look at some of the bigger and broader business metrics. And of course, you know, those were moving up on their own, and then with focus, they continued to move up. And even, you know, 6 months after we left, we were still seeing the overall kind of productivity of the place continue to rise.
Yeah.
So, you know, so that kind of thing is really what it's all about. It's very rare, I think, in a large system of, you know, 500, 1,000, you know, 50,000 people to spend a year doing this work and feel like you're done.
Yes.
Really, our goal has changed. I think when we started, we were like, oh, yeah, we'll take them from zero to hero and flip the table over, and it's going to be amazing. Our new model is just if we can teach the teams how to do what we call looping, which is going from tension to practice to experiment to reincorporating those learnings and doing it again.
Right.
Just running that loop. If we can teach most of the teams or the teams that are kind of in, you know, that hold power to loop, then we can get out of the way and they can continue on their journey. But now they know how to take ownership of their way of working. They're actively managing their OS. They have a second job now, which is the, you know, work, not just working in the business, but working on it.
Yeah.
And so that's been the end state for a lot of our projects of late has been like, do we feel like there's enough competency now that you can keep looping?
Right.
And if the answer is yes, then yeah, maybe you're not the most, you know, teal, crazy, self-managed business in the world yet. And maybe you never will be. But are you getting better every day?
Sure.
It's really the only thing I care about. And if the answer is yes, we're getting better every day, then in both principle and practice, then that's great. That's exactly, you know, that's what we want to be.
Cool. I mean, that sounds good. I mean, but I guess it can't be easy all of the time. I mean, because sometimes this, you know, I think you're talking about people changing mindset, changing habits.
It's hard. It's harder.
It's hard work. And so what's kind of the one of the biggest challenges that you face when you've kind of gone in to help companies with their, you know, reinvention or a transformation or a reconfiguration or whatever, rethinking of their organization? What's some of the biggest challenges that you faced?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, the first one that you hit on the head is that, you know, you are choosing to take on something that can be a little bit more difficult, right? Greatness is not easy.
No.
And so, you know, one of the metaphors I use in the book is the difference between a lighted intersection and a roundabout.
Right.
And the roundabout is empirically better in almost every way, but in most contexts. Mm. But what I like to talk about more specifically is when you're in a lighted intersection where you're being controlled, it's actually quite relaxing. Right. Mm-hmm. You can just get on your phone and wait for the light to turn green and it's not on you.
Sure.
But when you're in the roundabout, you have to be on.
Yes.
You are responsible and you're present.
Yes.
And so I think one of the things that is a headwind in this way of working is that one of the ways that we get more performance and we get better outcomes and we get to achieve our purpose and we get more meaning in the work is because everybody's on notice, right? We're all present. We're all rowing. We're all in it. We're all doing the roundabout. And so that can be challenging for some. That can be tiring. It can be off-putting after a career of phoning it in, et cetera. So that's a challenge. I think the number one challenge we see is actually just creating the space and time for this work.
Right.
You know, it all sounds great until you're like, hey, I need an hour a week where you're going to get with the team and do a retrospective and figure out what's serving you, what isn't, and design what you're going to tweak the next week. And it's like, wow, an hour? We've got a lot of deadlines to hit for the quarter and I'm tired and I'm just not sure it's worth it, right? So people kind of peter out when the rubber meets the road on making time.
Sure.
And sometimes I don't blame them. I mean, you can be in environments where that's really hard, but that is the price of entry, right? If you can't make the time to be paying attention and noticing, then you can't really play.
Yeah.
So that's a challenge. And then the third, and I think the most pernicious, is ego.
Yeah.
So much of our identity is wrapped up in the roles that we hold and the titles and the power and the activities that we do that feel like work and the theater of work and, you know, all the dynamics that go into kind of the current way. And so when you start to strip those away, there's a lot of crisis that can happen, identity crisis, ego crisis.
Yes.
To say like, well, who am I if I'm not approving everyone's work? Or who am I if I'm not watching the clock to see who's on time? And who am I if I'm not, you know, like, what does it mean? Do I need to exist anymore? What's my job as a leader? And vice versa, there's crisis on the other side of like, hey, I've been able to hide and now I'm not allowed to hide.
Sure.
I have to, you know, I have a voice and I have to use it. And things are expected of me that weren't before. And I have this new, this new freedom and autonomy, but it's kind of scary. So I think you get both sides have crises. And finding your way through that is really the most important part of the work.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that I was talking to somebody about it, to the ops director, one of the, I think it was at Virgin Holidays earlier on today, and we were talking about this idea, particularly in around sort of leadership and ego, and the idea of the people's relationship to the word service and what it means to be in service to somebody or to serve. And I think there's an ego thing, but there's also almost a philosophical linguistic thing in there as well about what's your relationship to that word in terms of how do you feel about serving kind of people? How do you feel about being in service? How do you feel about people that work in service positions, et cetera, et cetera? And do you equate service with subservience and all of that type of stuff?
Right.
It's right. Fascinating. And you get right into the kind of the id of somebody in many ways.
That's super fascinating.
And so,
the power dynamics are critical. I mean, they crop up in all these weird ways, like you said, with that word, right? Is that a powerful word or is that a word of subservience?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's a rich vein of there, but then it starts, you know, you've got to set yourself up to have really brave and very open conversations. I mean, because there's some of those conversations for people and some of those considerations are going to be quite hard as well.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of growth that comes. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about working in this way is you do shine a light on a lot of those things that you get to tuck away otherwise. and assumptions and beliefs and insecurities and all that kind of stuff comes out to roost. And sometimes it can feel worse for a while.
Yes.
Because it's all out. You know, you've sort of lifted up the cushion and seen all the crumbs underneath. But then if you can push through and if you can really rise to the occasion, then you kind of get the, you get to clean that out and you get to, you know, move beyond that. And I think it does take a certain amount of boldness. I mean, you know, the book is called Brave New Work for a reason. It's not called Easy New Work or, you know, anything like that.
Yes.
So I think that is a part of it. And, you know, the benefits are huge, but the investment is high.
Absolutely. So if I was to say to you that, you know, somebody's listening into this, they're an exec or a leader in an organization, big organization or their own organization, and they're thinking, I am liking the sound of what Aaron's saying. Now, apart from going off and buying your book, which obviously that's what they should do, and it's going to be on sale from February the 19th, and that's kind of fair enough. But it's, it, in many ways, before they get the book, if I was to ask you to suggest, you know, a place where they should start, because like you say, is, you know, starting something or, you know, taking the first step is sometimes the most critical, because you want to do something that where you feel like you're making kind of progress, as it were. So what would you encourage them to start? What should they do first, or what should they ask themselves first?
No, it's a great question. I think there's a conversation they could have, or there's an activity they could do, right? So
okay.
The conversation is to go back to their team and just say, if you could change something, what would you change?
Right.
You know, what's stopping you from doing the best work of your life? Just ask the question, have the conversation without a promise of what will happen next.
Mm-hmm.
But just to see what's in everybody's head.
Yeah.
And model it yourself by being like, you know what I'd like to change is X, Y, or Z.
Yes.
So I think part of it is you can invite that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And the activity, which is related, but I think more hands-on, is at the end of the next project or the end of the next month, whichever comes first, grab the team and do a retrospective. And that means getting everybody together. And, you know, there's many, if you Google how to hold a retrospective, there's 15 different ways to do it online.
Sure.
But you're essentially asking the question, what worked, what didn't work, and what will we do differently next time we do this thing?
Mm.
And I think that, you know, there's a ton of power in that idea. We have a partner and an investment that we've made in a software company called Parabol, Parabol.co.
Okay.
And they've created a free retrospective tool online.
Nice.
So you can actually have a team use it in person or remotely, and it runs you through a formatted approach to getting at some of these insights. So that's kind of a potential way to get at it. But you can do it with Post-it notes too. I mean, it really is just about taking the hour and or the 90 minutes and saying, hey, what happened? What the hell just happened? Instead of going right to the next project and right to the next month, you know, less than 5% of teams do effective regular retrospectives. So
wow.
You can be in the top 5% pretty easily. You just have to do one. And I always joke that the best retrospective is the one you do. So it doesn't really matter what format you use or how well you stick to it. It's just, can you make the time? So those two things would be great places to start. And then, as you mentioned, you know, the book is interesting. We have these tension and practice cards as well that we're going to be releasing soon to the public. So those are fun tools to help if you feel a little bit out of your element and you want the support of some tools.
Yeah.
Start by starting.
Perfect. That's awesome. So, Aaron, I mean, anything else that you'd like to add before that we've missed out, or have we kind of covered off most bases?
I think we've painted a good picture. The only kind of parting thought is, you know, just remember that this is all made up. Nothing that we do at work, nothing that we use, nothing that we say is platonic. It's not floating in a cloud somewhere as the only way to do it. This is all completely made up.
Yep.
And so it can be remade. And that, I think that just acknowledging that gives us a kind of a freedom.
Yes.
To be like, oh, wow, I'm actually, this is just made up and I can just make up another thing. And if it works better, then wouldn't that be great?
That's super cool. Aaron, just want to say thank you for your time today. Congratulations on the new work. My chapeau on the work that you're doing and trying to help reinvent a number of different of willing organizations. I guess you've got a fair few in the willing before you get to the unwilling, and that's going to be a much harder job. But let's kind of like,
exactly.
Hopefully you can grow the pond of the willing kind of pretty quickly. So, but yeah, just thank you for your time and sharing the insights today, and also kind of like telling us a bit about the book. That's been kind of awesome. Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for the great questions, and thanks everyone for listening.
Well, that's it for another interview. I really hope you enjoyed it. Now, every time I complete one of these interviews, I learn something new, and I try and incorporate that new learning into my writing, my speaking, my workshops, and the consulting that I do for my clients. If you're interested, you can find out more about how I work with clients over at adriansmusko.com. But one final thing before I go, please consider heading over to iTunes or whichever podcast platform you choose to use, and do leave a review. Every little helps, as they say. Anyway, that's all for now. Thank you for listening, and do listen in again. All the very best.